Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network. I am Deidre Tyler, host. Today, we'll be talking with Nicholas Dagan Bloom, author of The Great American Transit Disaster, A Century of Austerity, Autocentric Planning, and White Flight. How are you doing today?
I'm well. Thank you so much, Deidre. How are you?
Great. Now, I wonder if you could tell the audience something about yourself and how you got started on this project.
Okie doke. Well, I am a professor at Hunter College, and I run the urban planning program, the Master's in Urban Planning program at Hunter College. And this book, I think this is, for me, this very personal book in a way, because I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, and actually started riding public transit pretty early as a kind of substitute for school buses. And so in the 1980s, I was riding these old but really interesting buses that were still in service in Baltimore. And I had a taste for it. I liked it. And I enjoyed the community of bus riding and so forth. And I was also in Baltimore during the years when they were adding rail service and so forth, like a new subway line and light rail and so forth. So, that kind of personal dimension kind of fascinated me. And even in my neighborhood in Baltimore, there is a wide boulevard, and there was a little bit of track that was like left over from the streetcar era. And that sort of was fascinating to me too. And, you know, there's this wide boulevard that had been built for streetcars. So I had a lot of questions certainly in my mind that I wanted answered about why, you know, a city like Baltimore and so many other cities, which once had so much transit, ended up with so little, right? And I wasn't satisfied with the kind of typical explanations that were out there about why there was so little transit in the United States.
How did you select the cities that you talk about in your book?
Right. So there are three types of cities that are represented that I think reflect kind of the fate of transit, right? The first of those two cities where really there's no hope for transit in a way, Baltimore and Atlanta, in the period I'm looking at, really the book really focuses in the from the 1940s to the 1970s. These were cities that were totally under private control. And so I wanted two case studies cities, one a kind of mid-Atlantic city, the other a southern city, to give a sense of what happens when you let private companies kind of have their way with transit. And it's not a great story. I mean, it's a great story in a sense of disaster, but it's a very sad story. The second set of cities are cities where you had a relatively early public takeover of transit. This was like Chicago and Detroit, I use as the stand-ins for those cities. And you'd think it would go better, where people say, oh, well, public ownership will be better. But in this case, it wasn't, because there were no subsidies for the public owners. So they basically had to try to figure out how to balance their budgets without any subsidies. And so they lost riders and so forth. They just cut service. And so didn't really end up being that different in the end from privately run unsubsidized systems. And then the last two cities are San Francisco and Boston. And these were cities I chose because they had both public ownership very early and they had subsidies very early. And those subsidies from the government, that is from taxation, will allow these cities to preserve like more of their transit. You know, if you go to Boston or San Francisco, you're like, why are there still like streetcars? You know, like, why is that? You know, it's because they had the money to keep these things going when they were losing transit riders, right? They built some subway extensions. You know, they've kept more service on the streets. So those are those last two case studies.
Tell us about the transit-dependent resident and the problems that you found from your research.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I mean, 100 years ago, most urban dwellers were transit-dependent. And the great news for them was that in that period, being transit-dependent wasn't a stigma. You know, everyone rode transit when they need to go, you know, more than somewhere that their feet could take them. And in fact, in many cases, transit was somewhat prestigious. Riding a streetcar out to, you know, out of the tenements into a suburban area to the streetcar suburbs. This is great. You know, like this was an opportunity to improve the conditions for your family and so forth. So the transit dependent 100 years ago was basically like most urban dwellers because most people didn't own cars. What happens, though, is as cars proliferated, as low density suburbs were created, those who had the money began to buy cars, and the transit dependent were those who basically didn't have the money either for to buy a car. They were discriminated against in the housing market in the suburbs, could not get out to the suburbs. And they became dependent. This is where being transit dependent begins to have a negative stigma, which is that they became dependent on systems that weren't very reliable. So as the systems disinvested, they didn't have the money, whether they were under private or public ownership in most of the United States, but mostly private until the 1970s, being a transit rider meant that, you know, it took you longer to get where you need to go. You couldn't get to the better jobs. You couldn't get to the better housing in some cases. And so that, you know, that basically meant a lower quality of life for many people because of their transit dependencies. And there develops also a very clear racial dimension in many American cities. Probably most, I would say at this point, where white people, as they had with public housing or as they had with center city housing, there was a white flight. They left behind these systems, which they had once widely used, and basically African-American riders became the majority ridership or users of this, what was becoming a public service. And what you see in so many American cities in the 50s and 60s before the rise of black political power were white mayors who were very hostile to the transit dependent, quite frankly. They didn't care what kind of quality of life they had. And they basically allowed for tremendous cuts to service. And the result was, again, being transit dependent meant it took you far longer to get to your work or pick up your kids or whatever you had to do because you were dependent on transit. And the other side of transit dependency in the U.S. even to today is, you know, it really means, you know, very often waiting in places that are less comfortable, either in terms of like climate, like most bus stops are not covered in the United States. Could be public safety, like late at night. So the transit dependent rider faces a lot of challenges, both, you know, back when in the post-war period, but also today.
Now, you talk about San Francisco and the bus system. It was developed in the 30s. Tell us more about that.
Right. So almost every American city, even as early as the 20s, but certainly the 30s, cities like San Francisco and elsewhere, they began pushing for replacing streetcars with buses. And, you know, the buses were seen to have many, many advantages over streetcars. I'm not saying they do, but, you know, you could change the route or they could run faster if the traffic wasn't there. And then a city like San Francisco, also like Atlanta, a number of other cities invested in electric buses, what are called electric trolley buses. And so buses really had a sort of flowering, if you will, in the 30s, 40s, into the 50s, a pretty high quality service. The difference in San Francisco from so many other American cities is that because they had this tax support, their increasingly bus and electric trolley bus system in the post-war years, in the 40s and 50s, 60s, they kept it intact and they kept the service going. And so buses had a better reputation, you know, because you could depend on them to show up more and so forth. They even ran them when they didn't have enough riders very often, you know, during some times, just to make sure there was some service there. And I think what that shows you is that buses can be great. You know, there can be terrific bus systems, but they have to be, you know, frequent, reliable, you know, nice quality buses kept up and things like that. And then you can really, like San Francisco today, most people in San Francisco who use transit, even to today, they ride buses or electric trolley buses. That's what they use. They still have a couple streetcar lines that become the Muni Metro underground, but mostly it's buses. And, you know, that's typical in the United States. But what's not typical in San Francisco is that they maintain so much more service. Where you don't really need, you know, I think it's that idea of like, how much service do you need so people don't need a car?
Now, you tell us that the nation started building, you know, everything around transit.
Yeah.
And yet they destroyed it.
Yeah.
What did you find about this auto-centric policy?
Right. So because we were a transit nation, let's say in 1900, and as I mentioned, almost everyone rode transit and so forth, you know, the stores located around transit, factories around transit. I mean, you know, even a city like Chicago, right? I mean, most people didn't even go downtown who rode transit because there were just so many employment opportunities and shopping out along the trolley lines and so forth. And so basically, if you go to a city like Chicago, you'll or like West Philadelphia, or you go to parts of Boston or New York, you'll still see, you know, neighborhoods that are intact, right, and built around transit to take advantage of customers, right, or workers, right, and so forth, riders, right? So there's stores right near the stations and so forth. So in places where some, you know, aspect of the fixed, usually fixed rail, but it can be buses too, where like transit was maintained, you'll see this kind of infrastructure of like of the city built around them. In places where those systems were eliminated, right, or reduced, that's where you see, you know, the stores would close. You saw a lot of disinvestment in those areas. I think about, again, you know, parts of Baltimore where streetcars were ripped out, which a lot of these areas had like very robust commercial districts along the streetcar lines. Once you start ripping out the streetcar lines, I mean, you know, there's a lot of customers gone. And remember, the commercial that builds up around like transit, they don't have any parking or very little, right? So they can't really compete for the new car-oriented shopper very well. You know, there's some street parking, but it's very difficult to compete. And so those areas really go downhill. The other factor, though, is that transit, like all other urban institutions, began to suffer from the widespread disinvestment accelerated by redlining of the neighborhood. So, you know, remember that the places where in almost every American city where you had the most kind of densely developed transit infrastructure and also densely populated neighborhoods, primarily African American near to central cities, those were the areas which suffered most from the disinvestment related to redlining, mortgage redlining, and disinvestment. And so it's not an accident, right, that transit ridership slips in these areas. Also, job discrimination for African-American residents. It's not an accident that these are areas, you know, begin to lose riders. They lose kind of the transit infrastructure over time because the neighborhoods themselves are collapsing. And we really see that like in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, like the riots in Baltimore and so forth.
Now, the first city you talked about was Baltimore. Tell us about what were the city planners doing at the very first beginning?
Right. So when city planning emerges as a profession in the early 20th century, it was not, and generally speaking, it was not very pro-transit. It really aligned itself, city planning really until the 1960s, from basically the 20s to the 60s, aligned itself with everything modern, right? And what was modern, right? Modern was the automobile. Right. And so what city planners did when they looked at a city like Baltimore, they said, yeah, you know, it's not going to work, you know, for the car. Right. This densely developed streetcar walking city. Right. Where all these streetcars are like, you know, going into the central business district and that's slowing up cars. Right. And so what they basically did begin proposing in the 20s and into the 30s and 40s is they want the city planners in Baltimore and every other city, they want the streetcars out because in their view, they slow down automobiles. They want one-way streets that will speed up traffic. They want boulevards. They want highways, right? They want parking for cars in the downtowns, right? And when you begin layering all these things on, they basically, you know, through what we call urban renewal, you know, these basically destructive policies, especially a city like Baltimore, which bulldozed the center of the city for what's called Charles Center, they basically do. They reshape the city so that a suburbanite can drive their car in and park. And, you know, it's no big deal. They don't need the transit anymore because the transit would be slower. It would be more socially mixed to ride transit. So city planners basically from the 20s to the 60s in almost every American city overtly, publicly were part of a kind of political consensus among what was then still a white political leadership. That city centers should be remade for the car. In fact, all of cities should be remade for the car. So in the center city, you put in parking and you have the highways come in and so forth. In the areas on the periphery, right, you do zoning, right? So you zone every, like in Baltimore, the new areas of the city that were added, you zone it very low density so that, you know, nobody's going to put much, you know, the private company's not going to send transit out there because they can't get any riders, right? And people who live out there, they're going to buy cars, right? And they'll be able to use those cars because there'll be boulevards and highways and so forth. So the whole kind of push of city planning in this era was very car-centric. And while we've known that to a certain extent, I think this is one of the first books that kind of lays out how city planning really helped undermine transit. We always talked about how they helped build highways, right, by demolishing primarily African-American neighborhoods to build these highways. But at the same time, they also have a lot of policies that directly undermined the ability of first private transit companies to operate well, but also eventually public transit as well.
Let's look at Chicago.
Yeah.
And tell us about the streetcars in Chicago. Yeah. And the Chicago riot of 1919.
Yeah, so basically in a city like Chicago, the streetcar system was once very extensive, and the maps are pretty amazing about that. And Chicago, like many northern cities, became a place where there was an African-American migration northward. And this African-American population was highly restricted to particularly in this period, in the World War I era, to the South Side, a few South Side neighborhoods, what eventually became known as the Black Belt. And yet, at the same time, African-American workers were traveling around the city, people were going for recreation to other places in the city. And so some of the only truly integrated environments of the city were the streetcars. And so it's not an accident, both in a city like Chicago, but then Detroit in World War II, that you have basically whites in particular attacking African-Americans on these streetcars as part of trying to enforce the color line, right? The kind of restriction. And, you know, the North as opposed to the South. In the South in this period, you had basically the system of Jim Crow, which on vehicles, right, separated white and black. But that was not the case in the North. And the response to it was not greater tolerance on the part of whites. It was to go buy cars, of course, the 1920s and 30s, to move further out, but also to attack African-Americans who were riding these streetcars.
Boston. Tell us about the Henry Whitney's West End Company. What happened there?
Yeah, so the West End Company was part of basically a tremendous real estate scheme, if you will, which were most transit companies, to basically use the streetcar lines to extend the streetcar lines out, and then thus open up new land for development. And that's what Whitney was very good at. The problem was that as the ridership picked up, as the number of streetcars picked up, this created tremendous congestion in the center of Boston. And ultimately, Whitney will be displaced by a kind of public-private partnership that will build what's called the Boston Elevated, which was the, you know, essentially the first subway in the United States. To basically, you know, put together the capital and so forth to take us to turn a streetcar line, right, into a quasi subway system downtown, right? Those streetcars even today on the Green Line, they're at Surface, out in Brookline, the parts that the West End Company and Henry Whitney did, right? But as they get into the city, they dive underground and become a subway. And so there you have an example where it's one reason Boston has more transit today is that even in the 19th century, it was clear, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, it was clear that private capital alone could not basically build a kind of transit system that would effectively serve the population. And so the public got involved in helping to finance the creation of a better system, which was the subway. And that early entry, it's like in New York, is the same. San Francisco has examples of this, tunnels. Anywhere you had to like do this kind of tunneling and more costly infrastructure, that's where you had to have the public involved. And because the public was involved, that's really important later on, where they say, okay, well, the public's already involved in financing this. Why doesn't the public just run it? Whereas a city like Chicago, where it was all privately financed, honestly, it's amazing that until about 1970 or so forth, that transit paid its way under, under private ownership. And then under public ownership, beginning in the 1940s, it essentially was sort of paying its way. And so there was this idea, well, you know, transit, you know, should be self-financing. But in cities like Boston, New York, and San Francisco, that pretty much played out early because of geography.
Now, you talk about the tax dollar and white flight. Tell the audience more about what was going on here throughout the different places.
The tax dollars and white flight? Yeah, so, I mean, transit, with almost without exception, is not able to... Well, let me back up and say, well, there's I think one issue you're sort of pointing to there is that transit in most of the United States into the 1960s was actually taxed to help support city budgets, which is incredible to think about today. But they had these things called park taxes and so forth. And so many city governments, including Baltimore, many others, they basically extracted money from private companies to help cover the development of parks or, you know, the road maintenance and things like that, even though these private companies were essentially running an unsubsidized public service. And, you know, that helped destroy transit. It was one of the factors that helps destroy transit because these private companies go, well, you know, our revenues are just dropping like a stone in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, but you're still making us pay these taxes and you're not subsidizing us. So as, you know, we still have to make a modest profit on this industry. We're not, you know, not a public agency. So basically they would cut service or raise fares to basically help cover the cost of these taxes and their other costs. So that's a big problem there. The other factor is that with taxes is that because most American cities stopped growing, particularly in the North where there was more transit, they're unable to annex really much territory around them. They end up financially strapped, certainly by the post-war years. And so there, as transit became this public entity, they didn't have the cash to help transit that much necessarily. And so very often they look to state governments for aid or a taxation structure that can basically go beyond city and suburban limits. And so that's what you end up with is a regional, like we often hear these things, regional transit authority, right? Something like that, right? The so-and-so regional transit. That's because cities are kind of broke, right? Most cities don't have a lot of money. And so there's this idea, well, you know, there's suburbanites who sometimes ride transit, city riders, whatever, will kind of merge this, take this private company, like let's say 1970, take this private company public and buy it out. And then instead of just being a city transit agency, it will be a regional transit agency with basically the state creates an authority usually to manage it. And they have some kind of basic taxing power. They collect a certain part of a gas tax or whatever it is to help support transit. But I should say it's not a lot, and it's really not enough in any American city to cover the cost of creating a high quality transit network.
Now, Atlanta, there's a whole different story there. Tell us about Ashburton and the changing population.
So what's going on in cities like Atlanta is, I mean, I see Atlanta as more sort of similar, I guess, than different in a way. But in a city like Atlanta, you had a private company, which was relatively successful, was considered relatively successful for a long time. And it also loses, but unfortunately in the late 1940s and into the 50s, it begins losing a lot of, frankly, its white population. But in the close-in African-American neighborhoods, they still had significant populations of riders. And unfortunately for them, they just didn't have the money to make it work. So they took what was essentially a high-quality, what was electric trolleybus system and replaced it in the 1950s and 60s with basically a diesel bus system. And riders in neighborhoods close in basically did not enjoy the kind of quality of service. These are African-American riders who had that they didn't enjoy the kind of quality of service that had been on offer, you know, 20, 30 years before. And then, to make matters worse, the white elite in Atlanta, basically many neighborhoods were subject to urban renewal, that is, clearance and other policies for highways, downtown redevelopment, and so forth. And so that further destabilized the neighborhoods that had the most riders. When finally Atlanta decides to build transit, what they do then is they focus on high-speed, rapid transit to really that really focused on the north side, more affluent white communities. So through these means, they basically disinvested in so many close-in neighborhoods.
You had a story of the colored jitney bus. What happened to that bus?
Yeah, so the jitney buses were basically run out of business. They were run out of business by the essentially private company that ran transit in Atlanta. And basically the black jitney services were an opportunity to offer in the, particularly in the 1920s, offer quality transit service that was not segregated for black riders in the sense by law. They were basically able to offer their own communities transportation. And they were driven out, as in almost every, there was a racial component, I think, in Atlanta that was different than jitney service in many other cities. But jitney service across the board in the 1920s, the private companies that basically ran transit didn't want to have the competition with basically a jitney service was, you know, a kind of like taxi service, right? That running alongside, let's say, a streetcar line. And so they didn't want that service. And in Atlanta, it's particularly tragic because there were these small companies that were basically developing that primarily serve African-American neighborhoods and basically allowed for African-American residents to avoid the kind of humiliating situation of riding on Jim Crow transit in this period. But those were driven out of business.
Detroit.
Yes.
Can we find some really interesting examples of how population decline and the financial crisis impacted the people in Detroit with transit?
Yeah, I mean the whole narrative. I mean, it's a right. I mean, as certainly, I think the economic collapse of Detroit cannot be separated from the transit collapse of Detroit, right? I mean, so many people who use transit use it for employment. So as the factories abandoned a city like Detroit, they also they robbed the transit company, which was publicly owned. They robbed the transit company of riders. So as employment goes down, so do riders. The other thing is that the downtown also of Detroit went into steep decline in the auto age. And that meant fewer people were riding transit into the center of the city, not just to factories outside. And so sort of the collapse of the city's economy brought down transit as well. I mean, I think there were opportunities in Detroit, multiple opportunities to build higher quality transit, but voters rejected them as early as the 1920s and 30s. That could have made it basically made transit more competitive with the automobile. I do think Detroit stands out in a way, though, because, of course, it was the Motor City. People had very high levels of car ownership very early. And, you know, the transit company began adjusting to that, and they almost did. You know, I mean, that's maybe the interesting part is they're very innovative. They came up with these small buses, small gas buses they were using. And those were very popular, at least for a time in the 1930s. So that was innovative. They came up with express streetcar service. So there were a lot of, like, I would say, missed opportunities for transit. But the problem in Detroit was that the public company had no subsidies. They had to pay taxes. And as a result, in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, almost the entire system was stripped of quality. That is, there were good quality streetcar lines, because Detroit's really well made potentially for transit, but those streetcar lines were ripped out, replaced with lower quality bus service.
Now, San Francisco, would you say that San Francisco was a success story in terms of public transit?
Well, I'm not sure it was a global success, like not by maybe by global standards, but I do have it in there because, you know, they kept more of the quality transit over time. You know, they kept more of their streetcar lines, they kept more of their bus lines, more of their electric trolley bus lines, and thus they kept their fares lower. They kept more ridership, more density of ridership. These were all really good for transit. And so definitely, if you look in like the late 60s into the 70s, San Francisco had definitely the highest per capita ridership of transit aside from New York. In this period, it was very high. But the other factors that helped San Francisco, though, had a lot to do with the city itself, kind of the broader qualities of the city. That is, they canceled a bunch of highways, so that helped transit. They didn't build as many highways as they planned, so that kept transit competitive, right? They also, as I mentioned, they subsidized transit to maintain a service over time. The city itself is encircled by water. It's small, it's compact, it's dense. They didn't have the big kind of sprawling suburban type environment within the city limits that so many other cities had. So, you know, density, also, you know, it was a financial center, a very successful financial center. And so you had these kind of, you know, these big office buildings built, which were difficult to serve with automobiles. So there's like a definitely a combination of factors that lead to San Francisco being more successful. On the one hand, you know, they invested in transit, maintained more of it. And the other, the kind of planning context, the situation of San Francisco was favorable to transit. They also got a lot of immigrants post 65, which is very important for transit in cities like San Francisco, LA, New York and Chicago, Boston too.
Now, what is the overall message you want the reader to leave with once they finish your book?
Well, it's pretty straightforward, which is that, you know, the quality of transit that you have in society has everything to do with the commitment, right, of leaders to basically maintain, and voters, right, to maintain that system, and particularly in very difficult times. It's very straightforward about what makes a transit system work. And we need to focus on those things. And those things are sufficient subsidies to basically make transit a reliable service, right? And quality service. That's very important. Policies that do not make everything about making cars go faster or easier. You have to have pro-transit planning policies. And frankly, I think you also need to encourage a multicultural society, one where basically people of different backgrounds and so forth can expect a quality service, regardless of race or ethnicity. And I think that, you know, how you get to those things are through the political process. And transit in this country now is fundamentally a political element, right? That is, it's budgets and it's political, it's planning context, and everything has a lot to do with the politics behind it. So people should, the choices that we make now will have enormous impact. That's my main message, is the choices people made 100 years ago about transit influence the transit we have or don't have today. The decisions that we make as voters and politicians or planners, whatever it is, those will influence how much transit is here 10, 20, 30 years from now. And so, you know, it's nice to think that there's some plot against transit by the car companies or other things like that. But the truth is, we also have to make better decisions about what kind of works, how we'll invest in transit.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Can you tell us about the next project you're working on?
Well, I'm thinking about doing some. I haven't. This is just recently come out, so I haven't decided yet. But I am interested very much in how New York, in particular, has tried to kind of build better New Yorkers through various kinds of institutions, whether it's transit, education, and so forth.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that. Thank you again for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Deidre. I really appreciate this.
And we've been talking with the author of The Great American Transit Disaster, A Century of Austerity, Autocentric Planning, and White Flight. Thank you.